Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Klosser coming at you live from my house. Welcome to Book Club Class. We are reading a book that's really very, very special, Wisdom from the House of Healing, Transformative Encounters of a Hospital Chaplain. The fact of the matter is that it is a book that is both sweet and sad at the same time. It's happy and sad. It's life. It's human and it's beautiful. And let's get right to it. Chapter 3, A Rabbi Comes to Christ. Now, this is, of course, an incredibly funny kind of a chapter headline for Chapter 3 because there is a phraseology in America, anyway, a come-to-Jesus moment. Biden used it recently talking about Netanyahu. He was going to have a sit-down with Netanyahu, and he was going to have a come-to-Jesus moment with the Prime Minister of Israel, meaning complete, honest, bare your soul, I got to tell you some secrets. It's just, that's the phrase that's come. Also, I mean, obviously it means religiously, potentially. It could also mean somebody having a conversion experience. So it's doubly funny because of the double entendre over here is that we're talking about Rabbi Balk coming to Christ, meaning Christ Hospital. Not that he's coming to Jesus as his personal savior, but rather Rabbi Balk is arriving at the hospital, and the hospital is called Christ Hospital. So A Rabbi Comes to Christ is hilarious because it's playing on that phrase, A Rabbi Comes to Jesus. Over here, the rabbi is coming to Christ, meaning the hospital. I hope you got that joke. It's funny. That's why he called it what he called it. Page 77, a little poem by Rabindranath Tagore, who lived 1861 to 1941, a Nobel laureate of 1913. Service was joy. I had a dream that life was joy. I awoke and saw that life was service. I acted, and behold, service was joy. That is really beautiful. Page 78, what's in a name? As mentioned previously, the chaplain is charged with reflecting upon himself in his work, as well as the patient. This represented a new spiritual journey to me that would take place in a new environment, one outside of my normal comfort zone of the more insulated Jewish community. As a minority, the only rabbi in the hospital, and one of a handful of Jews, I could not help but reflect upon another major event in my life, which presented me not as a rabbi, but as a religious Jew amidst a greater majority. The Hebrew word for shame, for name, shem, or shame, which is related to the word sham, I'm sorry, sham. I read this before, but I think he should have written in English, S-H-O-M, sham. But instead he wrote it S-H-A-M. In my head, as soon as I see sham, I said, oh, sham. You mean the Democrats? The Hebrew word for name, shem, which is related to the word sham, meaning there, has been said to not only be a superficial label by which a person is recognized, but a much more profound indication of what is there within the person. That's a Robert Hirschian idea. If we proceed further, we note that the Hebrew word for soul, neshama, similarly possesses the word sham, which we just connected to having the same Hebrew letters as the word Shem, teaching that a name actually is believed to somehow reflect the soul of the person who carries it, thus making a person's name extremely important. A significant feature in the biblical narrative is the change of names that various great figures experience, which indicates a change in their status and their destiny. Most famously, Avram had his name changed to Abraham. as an indication of a more universal role he will play as the father of many nations. Jacob had his name changed to Israel as an indication that he had struggled with man and with God and prevailed. There are many such examples. Sarai had her name changed to Sarah. Hosea's name is changed to Yehoshua, among others. I, too, have found that I have undergone changes of my name in different periods of transition in my life. I was born as Andrew, Andy for short, in the summer of 1973. At the age of 15, I spent 8 weeks on Moshav Nir Galim, a religious community founded by Holocaust survivors near the port city of Ashdod in south-central Israel. There, I experienced Orthodox Judaism and Orthodox Jewish life for the first time, including daily prayer 3 times a day, Torah study, and the strict observance of the Sabbath. I was also given my first pair of tzitzit, a four-cornered garment with fringes on each corner, prescribed by the Bible to be worn in order to remember all the commandments. That garment, as opposed to the larger tallit, a prayer shawl, is customarily worn under one shirt. When I returned to high school after that summer, I attended public school my entire life, not a Jewish day school or a yeshiva. I continued to wear this four-cornered garment, though not a yarmulke, a skullcap. I was on the basketball team, and when I changed into my basketball clothes after school, I made sure to remove the garment quickly while dressing and to take my time in the shower after practice so I could put it on after everyone else had left. Then, one day, it happened. While in the shower, my tzitzit somehow fell from my locker, much to the joy of my teammates, who began to throw it around the room so that I could not retrieve it. I finally got hold of the item, but the taunting did not stop. "What is this, Balk?" one yelled. I replied that it is a garment spoken of in the Bible that Jews wear to remind them of the commandments. Another responded, "You are so Jewish, Balk. You are as Jewish as lox," said another. "You are as Jewish as a delicatessen," said the next. Finally, it was decided by the last of them, "No, you're as Jewish as a bagel. From now on, we will call you Bagel Balk." I returned home that evening, not knowing what to do. I had been well-liked by my teammates and wanted to be accepted as cool by them and others. If it got out, as it most certainly would, that I wore this strange garment, it could make me the laughingstock of the class. On the other hand, I had committed myself to the fulfillment of this commandment and the others of an observant Jew. Should I give in to the pressure of my peers or uphold my faith? I was truly at a crossroads. The next morning, I wore my tzitzit, and my teammates called me Bagel, as they promised they would. And then something strange began to happen. The name actually made me more popular. There was even a sense of respect for me, because I stood up for my beliefs. Bagels would be put in my locker and in my gym bag. The cheerleaders yelled, "Go Bagel," or "Yay Bagel, Yay Balk, Yay, Yay, Bagel Balk." My teammates would recap some of the action in the following way, as if they were calling it over the radio. "Here's Billy Hayes coming up the floor with the ball. He passes it to Ricky Tibbles. Tibbles throws it over to Bagel Balk. He shoots, and it's good. Ladies and gentlemen, Bagel Balk put a lot of cream cheese on that one." I was even compared to the top basketball player of the day, and still one of the greatest of all time, not due to my skills, but to my new name, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, except that I was called Cream Abdul Cheese. I think you'll agree, you cannot make this stuff like this up. Years later, classmates who would see me would shout out, "Hey, Bagel!" Not Andy. I would smile when hearing that name. I would thank God for giving me the strength to ignore the initial discomfort I suffered and for helping me maintain the performance of the commandment for which I was initially mocked. For who knows what would have become of my spiritual growth had I abandoned that pair of tzitzit. I told the story as part of my essay when I applied to Columbia University. That is the type of impact the experience had upon me. I also used it in one of my first sermons at the celebration of a boy becoming a bar mitzvah shortly after I had moved to Cincinnati to send a message to the 13-year-old new adult member of the Klan that he should take pride in his heritage and not back down should others choose to mock him. In the end, I noted from my example, one would gain their respect if he stood up for what he believed. College meant that the name Andy came back into the fold. But after becoming a rabbi, as Andy is not a common rabbinic name, I decided to use my Hebrew name, also given at birth, but never used in everyday life. I will thus become Hanan, meaning gracious. That name suited me well throughout my rabbinic career, and is what anyone would call me in the Jewish community. Working in the hospital, however, would spark another change. To use the name Hanan would be difficult for the patients, both linguistically, in terms of its unusual pronunciation, and culturally, as a Hebrew name with which people were not familiar. My supervisor fully agreed with my evaluation of the situation. True, I could have used only my last name and become Chaplain Balk. However, I had seen other chaplains use their first names to create a more casual, friendly, and inviting atmosphere, and I wanted to do the same, especially when the sight of a rabbi walking into the room was bound to create a certain distance that would already need to be overcome. Bagel, clearly, was not an option. So the name Andy, which I had happily discarded when I became a rabbi and never wanted to use again, suddenly would be resurrected. Leave it to a chaplain to use such terminology. Except that my supervisor wanted a little bit more dignity conveyed in the name. So she called me Chaplain Andrew. Only later did I discover that Andrew was the name of one of the apostles, brother of Peter. I guess I had chosen the proper name for Christ Hospital. But no matter, the name stuck, and that is who I have become, at least when in chaplain mode. When one was summoned to serve in the Bible, God would identify and select that person for his mission by name: Abraham, Jacob, Moses, and others. There are times when God even calls their names twice, Jewish tradition comments, in order to reveal God's love for the person that he now chooses. From Andy to Bagel to Hanan to Andrew, I felt like I had been called upon four times to use a particular name for a particular purpose. As I now prepared to work as a chaplain intern at the Christ Hospital, a requirement of the CPE program, I heard myself say, as my ancestors did, as they accepted their missions, "Hineni, I am here and ready to serve. Use me, O Lord, use me." Who writes like this? Who knows how to write like this? Such beautiful writing. Come on. This book is so, so uplifting and so saddening and so joyous and so deeply saddening. keep coming back to that word. But that's life. But that's life itself. Life is its ups and its downs. You have weddings and you've got funerals. And you've got all these wonderful, happy things, graduations, and you've got funerals. That's life. What shall we do? He puts the entire world, a person's life, he puts life into this book, the ups and the downs, the sadness and the joy. Embrace it. A Leap of Action, page 84. This term was coined by Abraham Joshua Heschel, professor of philosophy and theology at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York for decades, I believe. He initially started at HUC in Cincinnati. Wasn't quite a right match. Found his way to the seminary. A Leap of Action. Jewish tradition puts great emphasis upon how the Jewish people accepted the Torah at Mount Sinai. In response to the Torah being offered to them, they responded, "We will do and we will hear." In other words, they were not told of the nature of the law and instruction prior to the revelation, nor was it humanly possible for them to review the content to see if they were willing to uphold what was being asked of them. Nevertheless, as they believed that God had surely desired to present them with something for their betterment and the betterment of mankind, they voiced acceptance of the Torah without even knowing the full extent of their commitment. Quote, "We will commit ourselves to your word and ask questions later," end quote, is what in effect they were saying. CPE, this chaplaincy approach, CPE to some degree takes this approach. It throws you into the environment in which you'll be working before you can assimilate all of the lessons of the trade. And for good reason, because you cannot learn many of those lessons unless you are engaged with the patient, as we mentioned, who is the, quote, living human document. And top page 85, I recall in my first position as a congregational rabbi, I was given a certain honor at a wedding, reading a Hebrew document that spells out the conditions of the marriage, which I had never done before. I mentioned it to an experienced colleague who was there, and he advised me, "Just do it as if you had done it before, and it will be fine." The same was true here. Most of us in the class, after all, were ordained and had led congregations. We had all visited the sick as a part of our roles as spiritual leaders and discussed theological issues with those who were suffering. Still, did I say a few paragraphs ago that I was ready to serve? To be honest, I can say there was one area every student was scared out of his wits to confront: serving as the on-call chaplain, a responsibility usually taken once a week throughout the course of CPE training. When a chaplain is on call, he is at the hospital and serves as the major executor of chaplain visits and responsibilities for that day, which is generally a 24-hour period. Aside from the need to see all patients who request a visit or those whom the nurses may recommend for a visit, as well as the obligation to help patients complete living will and healthcare power of attorney documents, the on-call chaplain must also respond to a code, the situation where a patient is usually undergoing cardiac arrest and an all-hands-on-deck alarm is sounded. When a code is called, and that can happen multiple times in the day, and sometimes at nearly the same time, loads of medical personnel run to the room, including the chaplain, whose job it is to seek out the relatives of the patient, clear them from the room so the medical team can do its part and seek to comfort them, pray with them, and, in the case of a death, be there for them as they grieve. Before I continue, I just want to make sure that this phone is working properly and that everybody who's called in can indeed hear me. Am I allowed to ask the audience? I know that there are two people who have called in. I'm delighted to have you aboard. I just want to make sure you can actually hear me. Can any one of you, we can hear?
I can hear you, Shmuel.
Great. Thank you so much. We'll now continue. At times, there is also a need to care for staff in such situations who may themselves be overwhelmed if the patient was one for whom they had cared, or if the patient was, in fact, not a patient but a fellow staff member who had suffered a medical emergency while working in the hospital. Now, if one is working on a weekday, there are senior members of the chaplaincy staff and maybe even other students who can be of assistance if necessary. I did my on-call work on Sunday because others had to serve in their churches on that day. I was alone. The thought that I was the one and only chaplain in a hospital with some 550 beds was frightening. I thought I was being thrown into a setting that required much more of me than I was capable of giving. After all, wasn't I just a novice? Such was my feeling during my initial on-call. The next time I served as on-call chaplain, however, I was calm. This feeling continued until not only was I not nervous, but I welcomed the opportunity. Indeed, I felt honored. Everyone in the hospital was dependent upon me, and I knew I could do the job. There was Soloveitchik once remarked, as he was becoming an older man, that when he entered the lecture hall to deliver a class to his students, although they were in their 20s, and he was in his 60s, and then his 70s, when the lecture was completed, sometimes 3 or 4 hours later, quote, I emerged refreshed while they emerged exhausted, end quote. That's a description of exactly how I experienced my on-call duties. I knew of other students far younger than I who, when they had completed their on-call day, were completely wiped out, while when I finished mine, I felt exhilarated. Page 87. Take it away that a visit to a sick individual will actually help the patient is not an unfounded belief. Judaism already expressed such a notion millennia ago in a very strange statement. The Talmud states, quote, one who visits the sick removes 1/60th, one of 60 parts of his illness. That's in the Nedarim 39b. Clearly, questions abound concerning the meaning of the statement. Where does the number 1 over 60 come from? What does it mean that he removes a portion of his illness? Is this a medical fact? The Talmud states in another source, and this is in Brachot 57b, fire is 1/60th of hell. Honey is 1/60th of the manna from heaven. A dream is 1/60th of prophecy. Sleep is 1/60th of death. And the Sabbath is 1/60th of the world to come. Now, how about that? Whoever thought of these terms, these day in and day out items, fire, honey, dreams, sleep, of course, the Jewish Sabbath. But the other things are known to all mankind, right? A little honey, a little, you have a dream, you see a fire, you go to sleep at night. And these things are 1/60th of the bigger picture that they belong to. Apparently, these items have an element that relates in a small way to these other larger realms. One burned by fire experiences a bit of the terrible punishment that awaits the sinner. One can taste in honey a bit of the sweetness of the miracle food which God provided for the Jewish people in the desert. One sees visions and dreams, as in prophecy. One is at rest while asleep, as in death. And one is strongly connected to the spiritual world on the Jewish Sabbath, as in the world to come. Top page 88. In the case of visiting the sick, the common factor is the element of healing. A visit to a person who is suffering, the Talmud is teaching, is actually an act of healing in and of itself. Its measure may be small, but it's not insignificant. While one might think the healing of an illness may be delegated only to the area of the physical ailments of the patient, we must understand that the strengthening of the emotional and psychological components that have become weakened in the wake of suffering brings healing as well. A healing of the soul. So again, we must understand, I'll repeat that, that the strengthening of the emotional and psychological components that have become weakened in the wake of suffering, while that strengthening of those emotional and psychological components brings healing as well. A healing of the neshama, of the soul. In what way is this so? A person often feels lonely in his ordeal, without interaction with the people who usually love and care for him. Even when brought to the best hospital, he is isolated from the living that's going on outside of its walls. This separation from family and society often leads to feelings of anxiety and depression, as well as to the unanswerable questions. Why me? Why have I been selected from others to suffer in this way? These spoken or unspoken questions intensify an already fearful sense of loneliness and abandonment that is greatly taking its toll upon the patient. When a visitor breaks through the barriers that have separated the patient from others, showing his depth of concern, not necessarily through the actual conversation that was had, but just by taking time from his schedule to seek out the patients, the powerful and healing message that is conveyed is, you are important to us. We miss you. We need you. We are praying for you. You are a part of us. You are not alone. I can guarantee that no medicine or therapy is going to uplift a patient who is in a stressful emotional situation more than a visit from those who care about him. Wow. No medicine, no therapy can equal Beaker Cholin. Why is that? It's me talking. Now it's Plotzman riffing on us. Why is he right? Why is Rabbal correct? It's because a human being is looking for another human being to sympathize with him or her, to understand what he or she is going through, to take time out of his or her schedule, like you said. But no pill, no pill, no medicine, no physical therapy would ever be able to equal that. Imagine if you took a pill. Would it help? It might make you a little bit happier. Maybe it hits certain brain receptors. I don't know. But what can make a person more joyous than seeing a friend, a relative, come into the hospital room with a smile, maybe some hot chicken soup or something else, and hand it to the patient and say, we're thinking of you. When are you coming back? We wish you were a for Shalema. What can I do for you? How can I help you? That human-to-human interaction. is so critical, so important. The mitzvah is so overwhelmingly, decisively important that God himself taught us the importance of it when he visited Abraham after the Brit Milah. And so if the Almighty visits the sick, we visit the sick. I'll read it again. I can guarantee that no medicine or therapy is going to uplift the patient who's in a stressful emotional situation more than a visit from those who care about him. Perhaps a chaplain visiting patient after patient as he does can attest to this better than anyone. There were situations when a person was deathly ill and I prayed for him, knowing it was not enough. And I said with as much sincerity as anything I have ever said, quote, I am so sorry. I cannot help you and that you are in this situation. I wish so much I could make you feel better, end quote. The response from such patients was almost always the following. You just did that, chaplain. You just did that. An eye-opening discovery. What would people think of a chaplain who was a rabbi wandering the halls of the Christ Hospital with a large black yarmulke on his head? How would they relate to him when he told them he could not dine with them in the cafeteria, the major gathering place for social interaction in the hospital, as he could not eat the hospital's food because it wasn't kosher? How would the female nurses respond when they discovered that as an Orthodox Jew, this rabbi could not casually touch them, nor could they casually touch him in the friendly manner that most do as a part of the medical team? Did the hospital population have any prior relationship with Jews? Did the hospital population have any prior relationships with rabbis? Did the hospital population have any prior relationships with Orthodox rabbis? To my surprise, the first few moments of orientation for new employees of the hospital put many of my fears to rest. I had presumed that the Christ Hospital, as the name would seem to indicate, was a Christian institution. I had presumed that the Christ Hospital, as the name would seem to indicate, was a Christian institution. That was not the case. It had, to be sure, originated as a hospital with a Christian origin, but was now non-denominational. Of course, the fact that the patients in the hospital were overwhelmingly of the Christian faith meant Christian religious services and rituals were provided regularly. And the hospital employed a Catholic priest because these were major patient needs. When I told my Jewish friends that I was serving as a chaplain at the Christ Hospital, they often responded with surprise. How many Jewish patients are at the Christ Hospital that they would need a rabbi to serve as a chaplain? What do you do all day? When I told them that my main involvement was with the patients who were not Jewish, there are only on the average about 5 Jewish patients in the hospital a day, they were even more greatly perplexed. Why would a patient who is not Jewish want a rabbi to visit him rather than a leader of his own religious denomination? Why indeed? An excellent question. I had made the same presumption when I entered the CPE program. I was expecting patients who were not Jewish, that is, everyone, to politely turn me down and request a spiritual leader of their own faith to visit them. This would not have upset me in the least. Why would a person who is suffering and often nearing death not want a person to speak to him or pray for him, who understands him, who is spiritually grounded in the same religious background, history, and culture? It made perfect sense. It also created a lack of confidence within me, not overbearing in nature, but certainly present with the belief that I would be rejected. To prepare for these occurrences, I tried to become familiar with the different denominations of Christianity so that I could carry on an intelligent conversation about the religious practices and backgrounds of apostolic, Baptist, Catholic, Episcopalian, Evangelical, Lutheran, Methodist, Nazarene, Pentecostal, Presbyterian, and Seventh-day Adventist patients. As I would discover, however, I could not have been more wrong about what would transpire. The patients were completely open to my presence as their chaplain. It was a welcome of which I could never have dreamed. My error in the assessment of the patient constituency, which would be it receiving me, reminded me of a beautiful statement I once saw that had been voiced by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., which is as vital to our society today as it was when he made it. Quote, people fail to get along because they fear each other. And they fear each other because they don't know each other. And they don't know each other because they don't communicate with each other. End quote. How true are these words? As a rabbi, I had never had any friends who were not Jewish. This is the result of a lifestyle and occupation that generally only provided opportunities to interact with other Jews, be it in my congregation or the larger community. But now, reaching out and communicating with a group I had not known, well, that changed everything. My spiritual orbit, which had grown from a personal to a national experience, would now encompass all those in my midst. Matters of the Heart, page 93. There were those who suggested that when a person is very sick, he is not picky and will take anyone who offers his spiritual skills to help him out. That is, they claim, the simplest explanation as to why I was so well received. I believe, however, there is a deeper insight that needs to be considered. I had presumed that the encounters between the patients and me would be ones greatly based on theological issues, issues of the mind. In fact, the issues that generally marked the points of encounter between chaplain and patient were issues of the heart. Such issues included death, family, God, hope, life, loneliness, pain, prayer, salvation, and suffering. These are issues that relate to all people. When studying different religions through books, a chaplain can certainly distinguish between their unique views on these subjects. But when actually in the room with the patient, he becomes aware through the depth of meaning of the encounter itself, there is much to share that transcends the varied spiritual perspectives that define us. This is not to say that either the chaplain or the patient compromises his cherished beliefs in meeting another of a different faith. Rather, unity is formed through a focus on common ground that both parties can comfortably embrace. At this level, identified by James Fowler as conjunctive faith, one is prepared to utilize his own religious structures to evaluate the authenticity of those of others with a willingness to recognize the disclosure of similar truth within a multidimensional framework of spirituality. Wow, that's a mouthful. James Fowler wrote that in Stages of Faith. Can utilize your own religious structure to evaluate the authenticity of those of others, transcending religious differences. Oh, I can do this. The tone for all my future visits would be set by two encounters that transpired very early on in my service as a chaplain intern. In one case, I entered the room of a patient who requested a visit. She told me of her maladies, her strong Christian upbringing, and her family. The conversation was full of references to God, who controls and guides everything, and who continued to be with her, even now, at the time of her affliction. This was one spiritual lady, a real believer, someone who I imagine speaks to God through an intimate relationship with him. At the end of our visit, I prayed for her recovery. She thanked me very graciously. I presumed the visit to be winding down and was ready to take my leave. It seemed that for her, however, the visit was just heating up, as she called on me to perform a faith healing to cure her of crippling arthritis in her knees. Top 96. The patient. We'll do a patient-chaplain dialogue. That prayer was powerful. Now I know you're a holy man. Put your hands on my knees and pull out the arthritis. You can pull it out. You can pull it out. The doctor says there's no cure, but you are a man of God. You can heal me. I'm sorry, but I'm afraid I can't do things like that. You must be thinking of someone in your religion who is known to do such miracles. Oh, you can't do that? She asked in a tone of resignation. No, I'm afraid I can't. Well then, see you later, she said dismissively, waving me off to the door. Well, I initially experienced a sense of rejection as the patient shooed me away. Upon further reflection, I was truly astounded and even elated at what had just occurred. Here was a patient of a Christian background who believed in faith healing. She knew I was a rabbi, Jewish, and presumably I had not accepted the Christian Savior as my personal Savior. And yet, this did not in the least lead her to the conclusion that I was not worthy of miraculously healing her. Well, I believed I was insufficient in this regard. She didn't. She truly thought I could do such things. And here's me speaking. Maybe because she was raised to believe that a Jewish rabbi could heal people of lameness and blindness and death and so on. So if a Jewish rabbi 2,000 years ago could do it, why can't a Jewish rabbi in the year 2024 do it? That may be what she was thinking. Maybe that was what she thought. Back into the book. Rabbi Balk says, I had wondered, even though I could not achieve healing for her in this manner, if perhaps because she had faith that I could, I should have granted her request and given it a shot. Who knows? Maybe she would have experienced some form of healing in her mind, much as when many people claim they actually feel better after I have prayed with them. Since one of my goals is to elevate and inspire the patient, did I err in not fully serving her needs? I concluded that I had made the proper decision. I was not capable of playing the role of someone who I'm not. I had to be completely authentic in my presence at the bed of the sick. In the second case, which gave me the confidence to successfully serve as a chaplain for all faiths, I was paged to the intensive care unit for a consult that required immediate attention. As I entered the room, I saw the patient's wife sitting with him on the bed. The husband was very quiet, perhaps due to his condition, and she did almost all of the talking. She presented me with the following dilemma. Her husband was in need of emergency heart surgery and was to leave within the hour by helicopter for the Cleveland Clinic, where the surgery would be performed tomorrow. At the same time as his surgery, her mother's funeral would be taking place in Cincinnati. What should she do? Go with her husband for a surgery in Cleveland or to her mother's funeral in Cincinnati? How is it possible to resolve this quandary? My first question to the couple concerned their own faith practices. They told me they were Catholic. I suggested, therefore, that they might want to ask the Catholic priest on our staff for his opinion. So I did not offer an answer that was not true to their values and traditions. They didn't feel this was necessary. You are a man of God, Rabbi, and you are with us now. We will do whatever you tell us is the proper thing to do. Well, that surprised me. Many Jews would perhaps not follow instructions I would give in such a volatile situation. Given the green light, I proceeded to tell them what I believed they should do from the wisdom of the Jewish tradition. After ascertaining their larger family would fully understand the daughter had to be with her husband in his time of need, and no great family rift would result, I advised the two of them should go together to Cleveland for two reasons. First, I argued, her mother would want her to go to Cleveland to be with her husband and would understand. Second, I explained a husband and wife are considered as one soul and cannot be separated from each other, all the more so in these dire circumstances. The woman immediately broke out in hysterical laughter. Laughter! I was more than a little taken aback. Was she laughing at my answer? Why is this funny? Oh, I'm sorry. I am laughing because you said my mother would want me to go to Cleveland, but you did not even know my mother. And besides, my mother is dead. Still, you correctly surmise what I know she would say. As for your second answer, and as she spoke, she grabbed her husband's hand and looked lovingly into his eyes. You are exactly right. We are one soul. We cannot be separated from each other under such circumstances. She thanked me profusely, and I prayed for a successful surgery for her husband, as well as for the soul of her mother. This experience had a profound effect on me. It provided me with the confidence I needed to know the lifetime of wisdom I had acquired during my rabbinic career would not go to waste, but was now available for a new community, a different community, but one that was just as anxious to absorb my teachings. Top 99. From both of these episodes, I witnessed the tremendous respect the patient and family had toward a man of God. No matter his faith, I would forever be inspired by these visits. A final example. I had been in the Christ Hospital, he writes, as a patient suffering from food poisoning. A family that I had recently shepherded through their father's and husband's passing was a floor below me, now surrounding their mother, who was quickly nearing her death. A nurse with whom I was familiar came to visit me and also brought me an update on the situation. She conveyed this message, a dialogue. Chaplain Andrew, apparently there's a family who must be a member of your congregation who asked me to update you on their mother's status. A member of my congregation? Well, yes, it seems so. When I assessed their religious background and asked if they would like to contact their clergy, they responded, "Our rabbi is here in the hospital." They said, "Our rabbi?" Yes, they did. Is there something unusual about that? Well, yes, there is. The family is Catholic. And still, they consider me to be their rabbi. After 3 days in the hospital, I was discharged. Though still very weak, I went immediately from my hospital bed to this patient's room to pray for her with the family. A few days later, she passed away. I spoke and sang at the funeral home before the Catholic Mass, taking place later at the church, as I did for her husband just 6 weeks before. The family thanked me and told me that they considered me part of the family. To a great degree, I shared those feelings. And for the first time, I was a rabbi with a Catholic constituency. Wow. Powerful, beautiful. We got through chapter 3, A Rabbi Comes to Christ. And God willing, next week, chapter 4, wait, chapter 4, next week is Erev Tisha B'Av. Next week is the eve before Tisha B'Av. I've got a trial in the morning, and I don't know how long it's going to last. There'll be no Talmud class that day. It could go on for hours and hours. There's no guarantee I'll be available at 1 o'clock. So I have to cancel Talmud next Monday, and I've got to cancel the book club next Monday because I can't crack out this book in the middle of the trial. So I want to thank everybody for calling in today. And Rabbi Balk, I sat next to him at Shal Shudas, at the Polsky Shal Shudas in Gulf Manor Synagogue this past Shabbos. And whether he said it over there or earlier, it could be he said at the table, Shal Shudas, he said, "Do you know what the most popular song is that I sing to people?" Because he has a very nice voice. And he says, "Somewhere Over the Rainbow." Of course, from Wizard of Oz. And I researched that song back in the day, and somebody wrote that "Somewhere Over the Rainbow" is the greatest song ever written. In the estimation of music experts, that is the world's greatest song ever written. I mean, that's an amazing thing to say about any particular song. But it is so encouraging, and it's just a beautiful tune with wonderful lyrics that it really is appropriate to sing to people who are in need of uplifting. And nobody better than Chaplain Andrew to sing it. Wishing everybody a great day.
Oh.
Yeah, Barry, you got the last word.
Yeah, you know what you have in common with Chaplain Andrew?
What?
Oh, you haven't figured it out yet?
My name.
There you go. And you know what the Wizard of Oz is about, right?
Yes, I think it is an attempt to get the United States back on the gold standard. The Wizard of Oz, meaning O-Z, meaning ounce of gold. Follow the yellow brick road. Follow those gold bricks towards economic stability, is my understanding. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's it.
Wow. I got it. I'm keeping up with the greater American culture. So glad. And yes, my English name is Paul. So I am, call me Rabbi Paul. Maybe you could say that. I wish everybody a great, thank you, Barry. I wish everybody a great day, today and tomorrow and every day. And remember, this book is meant to be cherished. It's got its highs and its lows. It's sad and it's happy. It's humanity. It's human life. It's so human. It's the world that God made, highs and lows. And we must embrace them throughout our lifetimes and mustn't feel, oh, I feel terrible. This book makes me sad. It should. There are times when you should be saddened for whatever reason he mentions. And then there are times that are just so, so soaringly high. Embrace them both, and you will have tremendously benefited from this wonderful book, the book Wisdom from the House of Healing. I'm so glad we're doing it. So glad you're calling in for it. I wish everybody only the best of health. With God's help, join us tomorrow live, if you can, at the synagogue for Isaiah chapter 2, and I guarantee you're going to see your eyes open up as we see verses in Isaiah chapter 2 that you know already. You know those verses, and you'll see them biblically in the text, not just liturgically in the sitter. Do not miss tomorrow's class. Call in or come live, but you will enjoy the class immensely, and I guarantee it. Wishing everybody a great day. God willing to see everybody tomorrow night, 7:30 sharp for Tanakh Tuesday, as we do Isaiah chapter 2. Wishing everybody
a
great one. Thank you, Barb. Thank you, Barry. Thank you both for calling in. Everybody have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow night for Isaiah chapter 2. Take care and be well. Bye right now.